men and women of jazz every week on Artist of the Week. And one of my all-time favorites is with us today, on the line with us today. And that is Mr. Jazz Excellence. I've given you your own name, Bob. I'm going to I'm calling you Mr. Jazz Excellence. And Bob James is this week's Artist of the Week, and it is an exciting new project that we've been previewing this hour, and now we get to hear from the man behind the project. And Bob, I guess I shouldn't ask if you've been busy.
Well, I guess very happy to report that I have been, in spite of these crazy times. I've been doing a lot of virtual stuff from my home studio, very recently, I also managed to forge out and do a little live performance touring, which was exciting, and having been away from it, you know, for mostly for those 2 years when we couldn't play in front of an audience. So that's been fun. It still has a little bit of anxiety about it.
Yeah.
We have to get out our vaccination card.
Yes.
We have to still wear masks most of the time and all of that. But I just came back yesterday and did my little at-home test and showed up negative again, so I'm okay for the time being.
Well, that's good. That is awesome. And that's one of the concerns a lot of folks that very much appreciate the work and the talent that all you all have. We don't ever want to think that, you know, something has happened as a result of going to one of these events. Even though we're going to enjoy seeing you, but we still want you to be healthy. I'm glad to know that you have a regiment that you check yourself after doing certain things. That's beautiful. That means you're paying attention.
Well, I am paying attention, and every now and then the government even does something kind of cool. I'm not sure exactly where or why that I got it, but in the mail, they sent me a new couple of kits, so that I could test myself.
Yeah.
And I just thought, gee, I'm seeing a lot more people when I'm not away from home that I don't know, and going into various places, restaurants or whatever, and I feel good, and no symptoms or anything like that, but it's still kind of nice to be able to look at the test and see that you're negative.
Absolutely. Yes, and I got mine too, and that was comforting to know, and other family members did as well, and I'm very, very relieved that they were distributed by mail and rather rapidly as well, because as you're talking about that, you know, there's, for us, you know, on this side of the aisle, you know, we have our listeners, and they want to do this and that, and they're kind of ready to come out and, you know, ready to do this and ready to do that. But at the same time, you know, we still have to err on the side of caution. You know, because
one really silly thing for me, but I guess it's not silly either, but very much a part of us going out to perform is to kind of meet and greet and see people afterwards and say hello. And these days, everybody wants a selfie. That's a new way that people deal with their social media and everything. So all of a sudden, you're up close, somebody you don't know.
Right.
And just the standard handshake thing is so awkward now, because we don't even think about it, and people will come up to you, and immediately their hand goes out. You want to shake hands.
That's true.
And these days, I flinch, sort of, because I want to do it, and then I don't want to stick my elbow out or my knuckles or something. But you can see by the flinch that you don't know whether that person has germs on them or not.
Right.
So instead of being the friendly, nice gesture, there's this hesitation that goes on that you just can't avoid it.
Right.
Our instincts are to say no. We better not be doing that.
Right. And to protect yourself, because you really literally don't know. And that's a fine line to cross, because the fans that adore you and your decades and decades of work, you know, they just want to touch you. They want to be by you. And it is hard. I know that's got to be difficult.
I like that part of it, too. Early in my career, I'm going way back now to like 1970s, 1980s, I was recording so much during that time that I didn't do hardly any touring. And even my record company felt like I was going to be much more productive by mm-hmm. just keep recording almost like a full-time deal and very, very little touring. And it's only been in recent years, with the business changing as much as it has, mm-hmm. that has made it so much more important to tour. Yeah, and I've got that feeling of the instant reaction from fans. And I learn what they like, and I am playing the music instantly in public somehow. And then sometimes getting to greet them mm-hmm. and establish a kind of one-on-one thing. So it's a recent phenomenon for me anyway, and then to have it thwarted yeah. by the pandemic where mm-hmm. I really want to do it now. I really want to perform live, but it's been so difficult.
And Bob, you are known to also be an international, a global phenomenon in this music. So I imagine, culturally speaking, that was a lot of decisions you had to make, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And I'm so proud of it. I'm so happy about it, having had those opportunities to go literally almost all over the world mm-hmm. and see how the universal language allows you to communicate without words. Mm-hmm. I go to the piano and it's still a piano no matter what country that I'm in, and we definitely communicate that way, and we can communicate jazz, our American form, mm-hmm. to people in other countries that listen to it in a special way as foreign or exotic kind of music in their culture. Mm.
And when they encounter it for the first time, can you talk about that experience and what they, you know, it's got to be a special energy that comes off of folks out there.
Definitely. We get used to our own audiences who respond differently to jazz than other music mm-hmm. because it's improvised and you're playing solos in the middle of a song. And then you applaud at the end of that solo, or you show the appreciation as the music is being played. But in some other cultures, that's almost considered to be rude.
Really?
If you would make any kind of noise while the music is still going on. Mm. Specifically, I can remember first times that I performed in Japan, I got kind of panicky because the audience was so quiet. Mm. I'd play what I thought was a pretty good solo, and I get to the end of it, and nothing, no reaction. So I thought, oh my God, they hated it. Mm-hmm. And the same thing when we would get to the end of a song, traditionally, the last chord of a jazz performance, there's a kind of sustained thing where the drummer keeps playing riffs, you know,
sure.
we're holding the chord, mm-hmm. and we're expecting that the applause is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And the applause comes in because they know you just hit that last chord.
Yeah.
But with the Japanese audience, at least at that time, still they were silent, completely silent, no reaction until every last bit of sound would stop, until we would finally get to the very end, and then they would applaud. Because in their culture, making any kind of sound before the music was finished was considered to be rude or inappropriate.
And then you get to America, and it's the exact opposite.
Yeah, it's the exact opposite, yeah. And we're, you know, I feel like I'm disappointed if I don't have a few people calling out to me, you know, hey, Bob, yes, or something, right in the middle of the tune, and so I'm happy about it. But of course, in some other cultures, that would never happen.
Well, we're grateful for you being... You know, you're just so cool. I remarked one time, I'm following an interview I did with you some years back. You are the coolest dude. I'm just like, you know, and when I met you when you came to Nashville, I was like, this, you know, is there ice cubes laying around here somewhere? This man is so cool. But you're like that all the time, Bob.
I love that as a compliment. I mean, I've been through several phases of what we call cool jazz, too. Uh-huh. The birth of the cool and all of those things when cool became a particular style.
Mm-hmm.
But I admit that I still like hot, by the way. I hope I can occasionally get hot.
Well, no, wait a minute. I call you Mr. Excellence, okay?
Even though I'm not worthy, I still like it, and I give you total permission to do it.
He is Mr. Excellence, and he's super cool. And, you know, speaking of cool jazz, that era, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because let me ask you about that time frame. You know, you stretched the whole length of contemporary jazz and, of course, exceed smooth. But cool jazz used to be the thing. Can you talk about that, please?
Well, sure. Just as I was talking about it to you now, I remember that Miles Davis album that was so influential to me when I was in college, when I first heard it, The Birth of the Cool.
Mm-hmm.
And there were these arrangers, Gil Evans, that was involved in that, and they were using a larger ensemble with arrangements, very intricate kind of arrangements. And that was my thing. I had studied arranging and orchestrating in college, and I knew how to do it, and I sort of felt, even at that time, that might turn out to be one of the ways that I could make a living, doing the arrangement part.
Mm-hmm.
So I studied it a lot, and the West Coast jazz, which was also known at that time as the kind of cool jazz, and Jerry Mulligan, Chet Baker, and I remember another trumpet player, Shorty Rogers, that I used to listen to his arrangements that all had a kind of combination of written out and improvised. So, yeah, those are great memories and great learning time for me.
Do you say or think of today's jazz blends as a combination of all that, or a culmination to get us to where we are today? And because you're known for so much in the genre and able to ease in and out of all this, but how do you see it? Because you helped build some of this.
It's still a mystery to me. I don't think I even want to try to figure it out too much One big aspect of jazz that I love is the unpredictability, that because we are improvising, we don't know what's coming next. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of scary or adventurous aspect of it that still excites me.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to put myself into those situations where I don't know what's coming. And I think the audience reacts to that too, that they're kind of going on the adventure with you.
Mm-hmm.
So in my overall experience, it's been a combination, both organization or structure or plan stuff, but making sure that there's a big portion of not planned stuff, of the unpredictable part. So if I had to try to categorize my life or what I have loved doing, it's how good I feel about having been able to do all of that, or to make the plans I've orchestrated for very large, even symphony-sized ensembles occasionally, and more often maybe 8 or 10 musicians, and then all the way down to the trio setting, which is still my favorite.
Yeah.
Piano, bass, drums, the classic thing where the piano is carrying the structure, but also hopefully still doing some unpredictable improvising.
Well, I think that's what draws the listeners in and the lovers of the music in, is the unpredictability of it. You know what I'm saying?
That's what I do. Even though the people who are new to our kind of music, that a lot of them don't even realize that we're improvising.
Mm.
I have people still come up to me occasionally and ask me, was all of that written out, or did you practice all of it? And they may not even like the fact that you're making it up as you go along, or at least they sometimes are really surprised by that, because they're used to music being prepared in a whole different way. I mean, even pop music, there's not that much that's improvised. It's pretty much planned arrangements, and it's pretty unique what we do in the jazz field.
It is. That's why, for someone to tell me that the station, they turn it on and they keep it on. That's the highest compliment the radio station could ever get, instead of, after that song, I turned it off. I mean, that's not what you want to hear. You want to hear somebody call you and tell you that they keep it on. And I've heard that more here than any station I've ever worked at. So,
that's awesome.
Yeah, it truly is. I mean, and, I've been around the world a couple of times, and just the knowing that, the satisfaction that they feel for music or for instrumentation or whatever, they're getting it. And so that means they're staying. And I'm all in favor of that. And it helps to have good music in our collection from artists like today's Artist of the Week. That does help.
I'm very, very happy and flattered that I'm still in your collection.
Oh, my God, you are. All the way to the Wayback Machine. I have some of your 70s stuff in the vault, and I have some of, just about everything. Now, this current release, Feel Like Making Live, and I love what you did with the title. Was that your idea?
Of the group?
No, for you to do the title, Feel Like Making Live.
Oh, my record company came up with that play on words. At first I thought, really, is that what you want to call this album? and they convinced me that it was a good idea. And now when people talk about it, yes, it gives a little bit of curiosity.
Yeah. I was like, what? Because at first, I said, is this a mistake? I called your promoters that sent me the singles and the music over, and I'm like, because I'm about to cut this promo, and if I'm not going to say the right thing, it's not going to go very well. And now I get it, because when you know what's on the project, this is all your great hits, almost your career. There's 14 on here. Did you pick these?
Pretty much, yes. I have to say that this is one of the most unusual projects that has ever been proposed to me. I'm very happy with this new record label that I've been involved with, Evolution.
Mm-hmm.
They're based in Hong Kong now, but they're mostly British people that approached me some years ago about signing with them, and they pay attention to quality on every level. The packaging, the desire to do as high-end audio as possible. And the president, right after I finished making my Espresso album, approached me with his willingness to finance me going back into the studio to do live versions of that music from the Espresso album. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it started out. But he felt like once we were in the studio to do this, he wanted me to record as much as possible so that we'd have video. And very often in the jazz field, there's not enough budgets to do very many music videos because they're expensive. And yet, we notice more and more that our audiences very often discover the music through YouTube or some other video source. And so he wanted to make sure that I was well represented in that way. And so he booked a studio in Seattle, Washington. And I went in there with my trio and just started. I didn't want to do too many tunes. And when he first started to talk to me about it, he said, "Well, why don't you do about 25 songs?" I said, "Hey, I can't do justice to any of them if I'm gonna have that much responsibility."
Sure.
So we knocked it down and ended up with the 14.
14 is good.
To try to give as much variety as possible. But it was really, as you could see, it's more of a studio album than an actual live, because there was no audience when we did it.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted it to feel that way, and to give that kind of impression, while at the same time having really good lighting and good audio.
Well, I just, you know, I find it interesting that all, you know, you did some of your top songs, and then you come out with Rocket Man as your lead single, the Elton John song. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. what made you do that?
Well, it was interesting to me, too, and I think that came out of one of the conversations with the president, again, trying to figure out what repertoire, and I don't remember exactly what he said, but it was something along the lines of, try something different that you've never played before. Hmm. And he was aware that in my past, going back to the CTI days, that was one of Creed Taylor's favorite strategic things, was to have jazz artists play some very familiar pop tune, only bring something different to it. So there was an awareness that the listener would have that was different from just playing an original jazz piece.
Mm-hmm.
So that may have been a factor in why we did it. I'm a big Elton John fan, and I liked the title idea. I thought it was unusual, but what was really fascinating to me about it was that as I started to learn it in the sense of playing it as an instrumental, I was very curious about the structure of it, because it's really almost a blues. But it doesn't follow the exact shape of the blues. It keeps going in these slightly different directions that I'm sure had a lot to do with the lyrics when Elton was singing it. But as an instrumental, it was deceptively hard to play, because it's a very, very simple little tune and just kind of blues structured. But it has some twists and turns in there that made it challenging for me to play it.
Well, but you did it with such ease. It's a song, when I first heard it, I'm like, okay. But then it sneaks up on you. you know, and I like the way you interpreted Elton John as also a pianist, as you interpreted his music. I just love it. I mean,
I'm good. Thank you very much for saying that, because that's pretty much exactly the way I felt. It snuck up on me, too.
Yeah.
And sometimes if it's something like that that you're reinterpreting, the temptation is to want to make some big deal out of it.
Sure.
But it didn't seem to be that kind of song. I felt that I got closer to his spirit just by being really, really simple and straightforward with it. Anyway, it was fun to do it.
Okay. Now, of these the other 13, can you tell me at least two that are your all-time favorites and you felt that, you know, the fans got to hear it, this is what you love, this is personal to you, or whatever? Are there at least two on there?
Well, immediately what comes to mind with that was choosing to play Misty. Because I have very, very deep memories of playing that song hundreds of times with Sarah Vaughan. Because back in the 1960s, when I was her music director for 4.5 years, that was the song that we had to play on every show. And that was Sarah's hit, or her biggest song that the audience always wanted to hear. And so I have wonderful memories of trying to support her properly. And mm-hmm. when I first got the gig to play with her, I didn't feel like I knew how to play that tune. And she probably let me know that I had to pay some dues to get to the point where I could play it in a way that would inspire her to sing it. So there's a lot of memories there, and of course, it was composed by the great Earl Garner, who was always one of my favorite jazz pianists. So it has a lot of meaning for me, and that's why I put it on there.
Interesting.
The other song that comes to mind immediately is the bonus sort of last cut solo piano version of the song One Afternoon, which is a recent composition of mine that I, on my special album, I had done as a kind of synthesized orchestral version, but I had originally composed it as a solo piano piece, and I was starting to include it on my live shows as a solo piano piece, and so it seemed appropriate to make that available on a recording.
Well, so you did it. You did it, and I will remind the WFSK Nashville Jazz Station family, if you love Bob James, you just put this on, and it's all good. It's all good. Feel like making live his latest release. And, Bob, I know you're got a lot going on, and you know, before I go, I see that you're from the Show Me State, and I'm from Kansas, so I understand that concept of the Show Me State. And what kind of music influenced you growing up? Kansas City's known for an area, and St. Louis are known for a lot of different types of styles.
Well, I still try to get some logic about how I ended up in the jazz field from where I grew up, because it was not Kansas City or St. Louis. Mm-hmm. It was in a very small town, mm-hmm. Marshall, mm-hmm. in the center of the state, which was basically a kind of farm community. Mm. Not much of a music scene there at all, and what music was there was primarily country music. Mm. And neither of my parents were big jazz fans. They had a decent record collection. I remember there was one Stan Kenton album that mm-hmm. they had that I ended up listening to. But it was a very gradual process that something hit me about mm-hmm. jazz that I became addicted gradually through high school, and it was really starting to get serious by the time I went to college, which was not in Missouri, but it was in Michigan, at the University of Michigan, where mm-hmm. I ended up going to college. So I can't claim much jazz roots from Missouri, where I grew up. Mm. It was mostly listening to records, and I don't know. And looking back on it, it seems like it was inevitable mm-hmm. that I would be doing this for the rest of my life. Mm. But at that time, there was not much logic about it. It just mm-hmm. happened to me.
Wow. That's because you were born gifted.
Well, I know that there's a gift there that I got from above, and I'm very grateful for it.
Yeah,
and I don't spend too much time trying to analyze it, because that mystery is all part of it. It's part of what makes us tick. And I think I'm doing the best with that, just by trying to be honest, trying to be natural, and let it come out.
Yeah. No question. And, you know, Bob, I just recently had an opportunity as well during the Artist of the Week. I put the spotlight on Pete Escovedo, and you and him are around the same age, and you all just answered the question so good. I'm just like, these cats know what they're talking about, y'all. And I hope that...
Sure, if I don't know by now, I'll never know.
Well, okay. I just, all I know is I hope as the audience is listening that they are gaining insight from the absolute top of the shelf, the creme de la creme of this industry. And what a blessing it is for this station to have an opportunity to put the spotlight on them. And Bob, you know, you have made my dad be smiling for the rest of the day.
Well, I'm smiling too, but my cheeks are a little pink from blushing.
Well, it's true.
Your compliments are too nice, but I'm enjoying it nonetheless.
Oh, that's definitely. And knowing the kind of person that I am, if I didn't feel it, I am definitely not going to say it. And that's the fact. Bob James, and we wish you all so the best. And the Bob James Trio is it's just absolutely fabulous. And you said your label is in Japan, so does this mean all ordering and purchasing has to come through online only?
Oh no, absolutely not. They don't have actual offices here in the U.S. they're not a Japanese company. They're from they're based in Hong Kong.
Okay.
But hopefully they have pretty good distribution, and nevertheless, many people are buying things online, both CD and downloads,
yes,
and streaming, and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah,
it's available
easily,
as much as possible during,
okay,
or throughout all of those kind of media.
Excellent.
I hope.
Oh,
that's our goal. Anyway.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, we thank you so much. And Bob, I can't help but wish you much continued good health and long success in your gifted career. And it's a privilege for us to have the spotlight on you here in Nashville on WFSK.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate you playing my music, and I love Nashville. I hope I can come back soon and feel like making some live down there.
Oh, yes, y'all. Hey, that's what we want to hear. Bob, thank you, and God bless, okay?
God bless for you, too. Thanks for the conversation.
You're welcome.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.